Chapter 26. There was almost no warning of Skade's strike. For weeks, Clavain had expected something, but there had been no guessing the exact nature of the attack. His own knowledge of Nightshade was useless. With the manufactories aboard a military lighthugger, Skade could weave new weapons almost as quickly as she could imagine them, tailoring each to the flexing demands of battle. Like a crazed toymaker, she could spin the darkest of fabulations into existence in mere hours, and then unleash them against her enemy. Zodiacal light had reached half the speed of light. Relativistic effects were now impossible to ignore. For every 100 minutes that passed on Yellowstone, 86 passed aboard Clavain's ship. That time dilation effect would become steadily more acute as they nosed closer and closer to light speed. It would compress the 15 actual years of the journey into only 4 years of ship time, still fewer if a higher rate of acceleration was used. Yet half the speed of light was still not radically relativistic, especially when they were dealing with an enemy moving in almost the same accelerated frame. At their fastest, the mines that Skade had dropped behind her had slammed past zodiacal light with relative velocities of only a few thousand kilometers per second. It was fast only by the standards of solar war. Although the mines were difficult to detect until zodiacal light was within their volume of denial, there was no danger of actually colliding with them. A direct collision would be a very effective way of taking out a starship, but Clavain's simulations argued that it was beyond Skade's capability to mount such an attack. His analyses showed that for any conceivable spread of obstacles that Skade dropped in her wake, even if she dismantled most of Nightshade to convert into mines, he could always detect the obstacles sufficiently far ahead to steer a path through them. And yet there was a terrible flaw in Clavain's thinking, and in the thinking of all his advisers. The obstacle, when zodiacal light's forward sensors detected it, was moving much faster towards him than Clavain had expected. Relativity distorted classical expectations in a way that Clavain still did not find entirely intuitive. Slam two objects towards each other, each with individual velocities just below light speed, and the classical result for their closing velocity would be the sum of their individual speeds, just under twice the speed of light. Yet the true result, confirmed with numbing precision, was that the objects saw each other approach with a combined speed that was still just below the speed of light. Similarly, the relativistic closing velocity for two objects moving towards each other with individual speeds of one half of light speed was not light speed itself, but 8/10 of it. It was the way the universe was put together, and yet it was not something the human mind had evolved to accept. The Doppler echo from the approaching obstacle indicated a closing speed of just above 0.8c, which meant that Skade's obstacle was itself moving back towards Yellowstone at half the speed of light. And it was also astonishingly large, a circular structure 1,000 kilometers from side to side. The mass sensor could not see it at all. Had the object been on a direct collision course, nothing could have been done to avoid it. But the projected impact point was only a dozen kilometers from one edge of the oncoming obstacle. Zodiacal light systems instigated an emergency collision avoidance procedure. That was what killed them, not the obstacle itself. Zodiacal light was forced to execute a 5G swerve with only seconds of warning. Those who were near seats were able to get into them and allow cushioning webs to engulf their bodies. Those who were near servitors were offered some protection by them. In certain parts of the ship, its structural fabric was able to deform to minimize injuries as bodies slammed into walls. But not all were that lucky. Those who were training in the larger bays were killed by the impact. Machinery that had not been adequately secured killed others, including Shadow and two of his senior platoon leaders. Most of the pigs who had been working outside on the hull, preparing attachment points for future armaments, were swept into interstellar space. None were recovered. The damage to the ship was equally grave. It had never been designed for such a violent course correction, and the hull suffered many fractures and fatigue points, particularly along the attachment spars that held the conjoiner motors. By Clavain's estimate, There was at least a year's worth of repairs to be done, merely to get back to where they had been before the attack. Interior damage had been just as bad. Even Stormbird had been harmed as it strained against its scaffolding, all of Xavier's work undone in a moment. But, Clavain reminded himself, it could have been so much worse. They had not actually hit Skade's obstacle. If they had, the dissipation of relativistically boosted kinetic energy would almost certainly have ripped his ship apart in an eye blink. They had almost hit a light sail, possibly one of many hundreds that Skade had dropped behind her. The sails were probably close to being monolayers, films of matter stretched to a thickness of one atom, but with artificially boosted interatomic rigidity. The sails must have been unfurled when they were some distance behind Nightshade, so that its exhaust would not incinerate them. Probably they had been spun up for additional rigidity. Then she had trained her lasers on them. That was why they had seen coherent light emanating from Nightshade. The photon pressure from the lasers had rammed against the sails, pushing them back, decelerating them at hundreds of Gs, until they were moving only slowly in the local stellar rest frame. But the tightly focused lasers had kept pushing, accelerating and kicking the sails back towards Clavain. Skade's positional fix was sufficiently good that the sails could be aimed directly at zodiacal light. It was, as ever, a numbers game. God only knew how many sails they had nearly collided with, until one appeared directly in front of them. Perhaps Skade's gambit had never had a high probability of success, but knowing her, the odds would not have been too bad. There were, Clavain was certain, many other sails out there. Even when the worst of the damage was being repaired, Clavain and his cohort of experts were devising a counter-strategy. Simulations showed that it should be possible to blast their way through an incoming sail, opening an aperture large enough to fly through, but only if the sails were detected further out than was currently possible. They would also need something to blast with, but the program to install hull weapons had been one of those hampered by Skade's attack. The short-term solution was for a shuttle to fly 100,000 kilometers ahead of zodiacal light, serving as a buffer against any further sail strikes. The shuttle was uncrewed, stripped down to little more than an unpressurized shell. Periodically it had to be refueled with antimatter from the other craft parked in the Lighthugger's spacecraft hold, which necessitated an energy-costly round trip with another ship, including a hazardous fuel transfer operation. Zodiacal Light needed no antimatter herself, but it was essential to conserve some for operations around Delta Pavonis. Clavain was only prepared to use half of his reserve supplying the buffer shuttle, which gave them 100 days to find a longer-term solution. In the end, the answer was obvious. A single sail could kill a starship, but it would only take another sail to kill a sail. Zodiacal Light's own manufactories could be programmed to make light sails. The process did not require complex nanotechnology, and they did not need to be anywhere near as large as Skade's, nor manufactured in any great number. The ship's anti-collision lasers, never sufficiently effective as weapons, could be easily tuned to provide the necessary photon pressure. Skade sails had to be pushed at hundreds of Gs. Clavain's only had to be pushed at 2. They called it the shield sail. It was ready in 95 days, with a reserve of sails ready to be pushed out and deployed should the first be destroyed. In any case, the sails had a fixed lifetime due to the steady ablation caused by interstellar dust grains. This only became worse as zodiacal light climbed closer and closer to light speed, but they could keep replacing the sails all the way to Resurgam, and they would only have expended 1% of the ship's total mass. When the shield sail was in place, Clavain allowed himself to breathe again. He had the feeling that Skade and he were making up the rules of interstellar combat as they went on. Skade had won one round by killing a fifth of his crew, but he had responded with a counter-strategy that rendered her current strategy obsolete. She was undoubtedly watching him, puzzling over a smudge of photons far to her stern. Very probably Skade would figure out what he had done from that sparse data alone, even if she had not sewn high-resolution imaging drones along her flight path, designed to capture images of his ship. And then, Clavain knew, Skade would try something else, something different and currently unguessable. He would just have to be ready for her, and hope that he still had some luck on his side. Skade, Molenka, and Yastrusiak, the two inertia suppression systems experts, were deep in Nightshade's bowels, well into the bubble of suppressed inertia. Skade's armor coped well with the physiological changes, but even she had to admit that she did not feel entirely normal. Her thoughts shifted and coalesced with frightening speed, like clouds in a speeded-up film. She flickered between moods she had never known before, terror and elation revealed as opposed facets of the same hidden emotion. It was not just the effect of the armor's blood chemistry, although that was considerable, but the field itself, playing subtle games with the normal ebb and flow of neurochemicals and synaptic signals. Molenka's concern was obvious.
3 Gs? Are you certain? I wouldn't have ordered it otherwise.
The curved black walls of the machinery folded around them, as if they were crouched inside a cavern carved into smooth and surreal shapes by patient eons of subterranean water. She sensed the tech's disquiet. The machinery was in a stable regime now, and she saw no reason to tamper with it.
Why? Malenka persisted. Glavain can't reach you. He might have squeezed 2 Gs out of his own ship, but that must have been at enormous expense, shedding every gram of non-essential mass. He's far behind, Skade. He can't catch you up.
Then increase to 3 Gs. I want to observe his reaction to see if he attempts to match our new rate of acceleration.
He won't be able to.
Skade reached up with one steel hand and caressed Malenka under the chin with her forefinger. She could crush her now, shattering bone into fine gray dust if she dared.
Just do it. Then I'll know for certain, won't I?
Malenka and Yastrusiak were not happy, of course, but she had expected nothing less. Their protestations were a form of ritual that had to be endured. Later, Skade felt the acceleration load increase to 3 Gs, and knew that they had acquiesced. Her eyeballs sagged in their sockets, her jaw feeling like solid iron. It was no more of an effort to walk, since the armor took care of that, but she was aware now of how unnatural it was. She walked to Felka's quarters, heels pounding the floor with jackhammer precision. Skade did not hate Felka, nor even blame her for hating her back. Felka could hardly be expected to endure Skade's attempts to kill Clavain. Equally, however, Felka had to see the necessity of Skade's actions. No other faction could be allowed to obtain the lost weapons. It was a matter of conjoiner survival, a matter of loyalty to the Mother Nest. Skade could not tell Felka about the governing voices that told her what to do, but even without that information she must see that the mission was vital. The door to Felka's quarters was shut, but Skade had the authority to enter any part of the ship. She knocked politely nonetheless, and waited 5 or 6 seconds before entering.
Felka, what are you doing?
Felka was on the floor, sitting down cross-legged. She appeared calm, nothing in her composure betraying the increased effort of performing virtually any activity under 3 Gs. She wore thin black pajamas that made her look very pale and childlike to Skade. She had surrounded herself with small white rectangles, many dozens of them, each of which was marked with a particular set of symbols. Skade saw reds and blacks and yellows. The rectangles were something she had encountered before, but she could not remember where. They were arrayed in excessively neat arcs and spokes, radiating out from Felka. Felka was moving them from place to place, as if exploring the permutations of some immense abstract structure. Skade bent down, picking up one of the rectangles. It was a piece of glossy white card or plastic printed on one side only. The other side was perfectly blank.
I recognize these. It's a game they play in Chasm City. There are 52 cards in a set, 13 cards for each symbol, just as there are 13 hours on a Yellowstone clock face.
Skade put the card back where she had found it. Felka continued rearranging the cards for some minutes. Skade waited, listening to the slick sound that the cards made as they passed across each other.
Its origins are a bit older than that, Felka said. But I'm right.
aren't I? They do play this, there. There are many games, Skade. This is just one of them.
Where did you find the cards?
I had the ship make them. I remembered the numbers.
And the patterns?
Skade selected another card, this one marked with a bearded figure.
This man looks like Clavaine.
It's just a king, Felker said dismissively. I remembered the patterns as well. Skade examined another, a long-necked, regal-looking woman dressed in something that resembled ceremonial armor.
She could almost be me.
She's the queen. Why, Felker? What precisely is the point of this? Skade stood again and gestured at the configuration of cards.
The number of permutations must be finite.
Your only opponent is blind chance.
I don't see the attraction.
You probably wouldn't. Again, Skade heard the slick rasp of card on card.
What is the objective, Felker?
To maintain order. Skade barked out a short laugh.
Then there is no end state.
This isn't a problem in computation, Skade. The means is the end. The game has no halting state other than failure. Felker bit her tongue, like a child working on some particularly tortuous piece of colouring in. In a flurry of movement, she moved six cards, dramatically altering the larger pattern in a way Skade would have sworn was not possible a moment earlier. Skade nodded, understanding.
This is the Great Wall of Mars, isn't it?
Felker looked up, but said nothing before resuming her work. Skade knew that she was right, that the game she saw Felker playing here, if indeed it could be called a game, was only a surrogate for the wall itself. The wall had been destroyed 400 years earlier, and yet it had played such a vital part in Felker's childhood that she regressed towards her memories of it at the slightest sign of external stress. Skade felt anger. She knelt down again and destroyed the pattern of cards. Felker froze, her hand hovering above the space where a card had been. She looked at Skade, incomprehension on her face. As was sometimes the case with Felker, she framed her question as a flat, uninflected statement.
Why? Listen to me, Felker. You must not do this. You are one of us now. You cannot retreat back into your childhood just because Clavaine isn't here anymore.
Pathetically, Felker tried to regather the cards, but Skade reached out and grabbed her hand.
No, stop this, Felker. You cannot regress. I won't allow it.
Skade tilted Felker's head towards her own.
This is about more than just Clavaine, Felker. I know that he means something to you, but the Mother Nest means more. Clavaine was always an outsider, but you are one of us, to the marrow. We need you, Felker, as you are now, not as you were.
But when she released her hold, Felker only looked down. Skade stood up and backed away from the cross-legged figure. She had committed a cruel act, she knew. But it was no less than Clavaine would have done had he caught Felker retreating back into her childhood. The wall was a mindless god to worship, and it sucked her soul into itself, even in memory. Felker began to lay the cards back down again. She pushed Galliana's casket through the empty warrens of Nightshade. Her armor moved in measured funereal steps, one cautious pace at a time. With each clangorous footfall, Skade heard the whining of gyroscopes struggling to maintain balance under the new acceleration. The weight of her own skull was a cruel, compressive force squeezing down on the upper vertebrae of her truncated spine. Her tongue was an unresponsive mass of sluggish muscle. Her face looked different, the skin tugged down from her cheekbones as if by invisible guylines. Slight distortion of the visual field revealed the effect of the gravity on her eyeballs. Only one quarter of the ship's mass remained now. The rest was being suppressed by the field, the bubble of which had now swallowed up half the ship's length from the stern towards the midpoint. They were sustaining 4 Gs. Skade seldom went into the bubble itself now. The physiological effects, even though buffered by the mechanisms of her armor, were simply too uncomfortable. The bubble lacked a sharply defined edge, but the effects of the field fell off so sharply that they were almost immeasurably small beyond the nominal boundary. The field geometry was not spherically symmetrical either. There were occlusions and hairpins within it, ventricles and fissures, where the effect dropped or rose in interplay with other variables. The strange topology of the machinery itself imposed its own structure on the field, too. When the machinery moved, as it was obliged to, the field changed as well. At other times it seemed to be the field that was making the machinery move. Her technicians only pretended that they understood all that was happening. What they had was a set of rules that told them what would happen under certain conditions, but those rules were valid only in a narrow range of states. They had been happy suppressing half of the ship's mass, but were much less so now. Occasionally, the delicate quantum field instrumentation that the techs had positioned elsewhere in the ship registered excursions of the bubble as it momentarily swelled and contracted, engulfing the entire ship. Skade convinced herself that she felt those instants, even though they lasted much less than a microsecond. At 2 G's of suppression, the excursions had been rare. Now they happened 3 or 4 times a day. Skade wheeled the casket into an elevator and rode down ship, towards the bubble boundary. She could see the undercurve of Galliana's jaw through the casket's viewing window. Her expression was one of infinite calm and composure. Skade was very glad that she had had the presence of mind to bring Galliana with her, even when the mission's sole scope had been stopping Clavain. At the back of her mind, even then, she must have suspected that they might have to turn into interstellar space, and that at some point it would be necessary to seek Galliana's dangerous advice. It had cost her nothing to bring the woman's frozen corpse aboard. Now all she needed was the nerve to consult it. She propelled the casket into a clean, white room. Behind her, the door sealed invisibly. The room was full of eggshell pale machinery that was only truly visible when it moved. The machinery was ancient, lovingly and fearfully tended since the days of Galliana's earliest experiments on Mars. It had also cost Skade nothing to bring it with her aboard Nightshade. Skade opened Galliana's casket. She elevated the corpse's core temperature by 50 millikelvin, and then ushered the pale machinery into position. It swung and fluttered around Galliana, never quite touching her skin. Skade stepped back with a stiff whir of servos. The pale machinery made her uneasy. It always had. There was something deeply unsettling about it, so much so that it had almost never been used. Even on those rare occasions when it had been used, it had done dreadful things to those who dared to open their minds to it. Skade was not about to use the machinery to its fullest capability, not yet. For now she wished merely to speak to the wolf, and that required only a subset of the machinery's functionality, exploiting its extreme isolation and sensitivity, its ability to pluck and amplify the faintest of signals from a churning sea of neural chaos. She would not be attempting coherence coupling unless she had very good reason, and so there was no rational reason for the sense of disquiet Skade felt. But Skade knew what the machinery could do, and that was enough. Skade readied herself. The external indicators showed that Galliana had been warmed enough to wake the wolf. The machinery was already picking up the familiar constellations of electrical and chemical activity that showed she was beginning to think again. Skade closed her eyes. There was a moment of transition, a perceptual jolt, followed by a disorientating sense of rotation, and then she was standing on a flat, hard rock, just large enough to accommodate her feet. The rock was one of many. They reached into mist all around her, positioned like stepping stones in shallow grey water, linked by sharp, barnacled ridges. It was impossible to see more than 15 or 20 meters in any direction. The air was cold and damp, scented with brine and the stench of something like rotting seaweed. Skade shivered and pulled her black gown tighter. Beneath it she was naked, her bare toes curling over the edge of the rock. Wet, dark hair flicked against her eyes. She reached up and pushed it back from her brow. There was no crest on her scalp, and the absence of it made her inhale in sharp surprise. She was fully human again. The wolf had restored her body. She heard, distantly, the crowd-like roar of ocean waves. The sky above her was a pale grey-green, inseparable from the mist that reached to the ground. It made her feel nauseous. The first fumbling attempts at communication between Skade and the wolf had been through Galliana's mouth, which proved to be hopelessly one-dimensional and slow compared with mind-to-mind linkage. Since then, Skade had agreed to meet the wolf in a rendered environment, a three-dimensional simulation in which she was fully participatory. The wolf chose it, not her. It wove a space that Skade was obliged to enter under the wolf's strict terms. Skade could have overlaid this reality with something of her own choosing, but she feared that there might have been some nuance or detail that she was missing. It was better to play the game according to the wolf's rules, even if she felt in less than complete control of the situation. It was, Skade knew, a dangerously double-edged sword. She would have trusted nothing that the wolf told her, but Galliana was in there as well, somewhere, and Galliana had learned much that might still be useful to the mother nest. The trick was to distinguish the wolf from its host, which was why Skade had to be so attuned to the nuances of the environment. She never knew when Galliana might break through, if only for an instant. "I'm here. Where are you?" The tidal roar increased. The wind dragged a curtain of hair across her face. She felt precarious, surrounded by so many sharp-edged ridges. But without warning, the mist opened up a little before her, and a mist-gray figure hovered into existence at the edge of vision. The figure was really no more than a suggestion of the human form. There were no details at all, and the mist continually thickened and thinned around it. It could just as easily have been a stump of weather-worn wood, but Skade felt its presence, and the presence was familiar. There was a frightening cold intelligence beaming out from the figure like a narrow searchlight. It was intelligence without consciousness, thought without emotion or any sense of self. Skade sensed only analysis and inference. The distant roar of the tide shaped words.
"What is it that you want of me now, Skade?"
"The same thing."
"Use your voice."
She obeyed without question. "The same thing that I always want. Advice." The tide said,
"Where are we, Skade?"
"I thought you decided that."
"That isn't what I meant. I mean, where exactly is her body?"
"Aboard a ship," Skade said, "in interstellar space, midway between Epsilon Eridani and Delta Pavonis." She wondered how the wolf had been able to tell that they were no longer in the mother nest. Perhaps it had been a lucky guess, she told herself, with no real sense of conviction.
"Why?"
"You know why. The weapons are around Resurgam. We must recover them before the machines arrive." The figure became momentarily clearer. For an instant there was a hint of snout, dark canine eyes and a lupine glint from steely incisors.
"You must appreciate that I have mixed feelings about such a mission."
Skade tugged her gown even tighter. "Why?"
"You already know why. Because that of which I am a part would be inconvenienced by the use of those weapons."
"I don't want a debate," Skade said, "just assistance." "You have two choices, Wolf. Let the weapons fall into someone else's hands, someone you have no influence over, or help me to recover them. You see the logic, don't you? If any human faction has to obtain them, surely it had better be one you know, one you have already infiltrated." Above, the sky became less opaque. A silver sun scoured through the pale green canopy. Light sparkled on the ridges linking the rock pools and stones, tracing a pattern that reminded Skade of the synaptic pathways revealed by a slice through brain tissue. Then the mist closed in again, and she was colder than before, colder and more vulnerable.
"So what is the problem?"
"There's a ship behind me. It's been on my tail ever since we left Yellowstone space. We have inertia suppression machinery, Wolf. Our inertial mass is 25% at the moment, yet the other ship is still playing catch-up, as if it has the same technology aboard it."
"Who is operating this other ship?"
"Clavain," she said, watching the wolf's reaction with great interest. At least I'm reasonably certain it must be him. I was trying to bring him back to the mother nest after he defected. He gave me the slip around Yellowstone. He got his hands on another ship, stealing it from the Ultras. But I don't know where he got the technology from. The wolf appeared troubled. It shifted in and out of the mist, its form contorting with each moment of clarity.
Have you tried killing him?
Yes, but I haven't managed it. He's very tenacious, Wolf, and he hasn't been deterred, which was my next hope.
That's Clavaine for you.
Skade wondered whether that was the wolf or Galliana speaking, or some incomprehensible fusion of the two.
Well, what did your precious Night Council suggest, Skade?
That I push the machinery harder. The wolf faded, returned,
and if Clavaine continues to match you step for step, have you considered what you might do then?
Don't be absurd.
Fears must be faced, Skade. The unthinkable must be contemplated. There is a way to slip ahead of him, if only you have the nerve to do it.
I won't do it. I don't know how to do it. Skade felt dizzy, on the point of toppling from the smooth platform of rock. The ridges looked sharp enough to cut her skin. We know nothing about how the machinery operates in that regime.
You can learn, the wolf told her teasingly. Exordium would show you what you needed to do, wouldn't it?
The more exotic the technology, the more difficult it is to interpret the messages describing it, Wolf.
But I could help you.
Skade narrowed her eyes. Help me.
In Exordium. Our minds are linked now, Skade. There's no reason why we wouldn't continue to the next phase of the experiment. My mind could filter and process the Exordium information. With the clues we will receive, I could show you exactly what you need to do to make the state for transition.
It's that easy. You'd help me just to make sure I get the weapons.
Of course.
For a moment, the wolf's voice was playful. There was that flash of incisor again.
But of course, it wouldn't just be you and me.
I'm sorry?
Bring Felka.
No, Wolf.
Bring Felka, or I won't help you.
She started to argue, knowing how futile it would be, knowing that ultimately she had no choice but to do what the wolf wished. The mist had closed in again. The analytic scrutiny of the wolf's mind suddenly ceased, like a torch beam being switched off. Skade was quite alone. She shivered against the cold, hearing the long, slow groan of the distant tide.
No.
The mist closed in further. The rock pool swallowed the stone beneath her feet, and then with the same perceptual twist, she was back in the metal prison of her armor aboard Nightshade. The gravity was an oppressive crush. She traced a steel finger down the alloy curve of her thigh, remembering how flesh had felt, remembering the sense of cold and the porous texture of the rock beneath her feet. Skade felt the stirrings of unwanted emotions. Loss, regret, horror, the aching memory of wholeness. But there were things that needed to be done that transcended such concerns. She crushed the emotions out of existence, preserving only the thinnest residue of anger. That would help her in the days that lay ahead.